What we're talking about is late night and early morning low clouds. With a chance of fall, chance of showers into the afternoon, with variable high cloudiness and gusty winds. Gusty winds at times around the corner of Sunset and Alvarado. Yeah, I know, things are tough all over. When the thunderstorms start increasing over the southeast and south central portions of my apartment, I get upset. And a line of thunderstorms was developing in the early morning hours ahead of a slow-moving cold front. Cold blood. With tornado watches issued shortly before noon Sunday for the areas including western region of my mental health and the northern portion of my ability to deal rationally with my disconcerted, precarious emotional situation. Cold out there. Colder than a ticket taker's smile at the Ivor Theater on Saturday night. Flash flood watches cover the southern portion of my disposition. Yeah. There was no severe weather well into the afternoon, except for kind of a lone gust wind in the bedroom.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Monday edition of The French Connection. My name is Daryl Smith, and I will be with you for the next hour. We got some great stuff lined up for you today. First thing I wanted to talk about, is I'm a patriot and I'm from New England. And that might give you a hint on what I'm going to tell you. Being a patriot from New England and watching the Super Bowl last night in my solitude here in France, I couldn't have been happier. So the emotional weather report for today for Daryl is decidedly sunny. Anyway, so we'll move on to something else tonight. I got an issue with FedEx. I want to bring it up again. These guys were having some of their delivery people report on their customers, and I want to send out a message to all the people listening to me tonight that don't do business with these guys. Just, cut them off your list of people to do business with, because, you want them showing up at your house and calling up the local sheriff and saying, he had rubbish in his yard, or he had this or that. Who knows what they're going to report on, so maybe we just get rid of them from our system completely. Lots of stuff here. I've been watching this news developing today, and this one thing that stood out for me, I'm big on the veterans stuff, and there was a report on whatreallyhappened.com regarding homeless vets waiting years for aid. And, there's nothing more sinister in our government's situation than the treatment of our vets, especially when they come home after being in the Gulf. They've given them terrible diseases through these inoculations. They've poisoned them with this uranium shelled stuff, and then when they get them back home, they treat them like crap. Excuse the expression, but they just plain do. And I they're talking about homeless vets being one of the highest percentage of homeless people there is. And I got to tell you, that's just a complete lack of responsibility on our government's part and on the public's part. We need to pay more attention to our veterans because, they're over there sacrificing their lives and their futures and their health. Even though the cause is decidedly wrong, it's not their fault. They didn't make the policy, and they shouldn't be paying terrible prices like this. The Veterans Administration is actually being gutted as we speak. They're reducing services and injuring more people for the future. So something I wanted to bring up. Today's guest after the break here is going to be great. I got a week worth of information coming out toward you. Three of the days out of this 5 days, I'm going to develop a very strong case against the election being fair in Iraq to kind of counter the information that the Bushies have been putting out and the Mr. Potato Head and crew over there has been lying to the public. So we're going to make a good case against him this week. But we'll be right back with you after the break, and we're going to have Michelle Shostadovsky again from the Global Center for Research. Be right back with you. to be back with you, ladies and gentlemen. It's kind of exciting to re-invite somebody with such extraordinary credentials and research experience. One of my closest confidants as far as information is concerned, named Michel Shostakovsky. He's from Canada. His website is globalresearch.ca, globalresearch.ca. The site is just packed full of great articles and extraordinary research on a myriad of subjects. But Michael and some of his contemporaries have been concentrating on this past election. We've got several writers on the site that have worked very hard to try to bring out the truth about this election. And I'm going to spend 3 days this week developing a good case against that election being fair and reasonable. And so today I'm proud and honored to welcome Michel Shostakovsky again for an interview. Michel, are you with me?
Yes, I'm here.
Wonderful. Yeah, we got you.
Okay.
You're online there, Michel. It's great to have you back. You know, your information is just really telling. And I want to start out with a quick question here regarding some of the stuff that we found out. The first thing that we discussed on our call the other day was about that 70% figure that came out right away and how phony that was. And I'm actually seeing some of this information reach the mainstream press. Can you develop for me a little bit about...
Yeah. When the elections occurred on the 30th of January, immediately before the polling booths had actually closed, the 72% voter participation, which is very high by any standards, mm-hmm. was mentioned. In other words, they said 72%, a great success, big turnout, and so on. And this figure was then fed into the news chain, and it was quoted on network television, on the talk shows, and so on. But it turned out to be fabricated. I mean, fabricated in the sense that it didn't correspond to any kind of tallying of the number of people who had actually voted.
Do we know the source for this original number?
It was a quotation from one of the members of the interim government, Planning Minister Mahdi Al-Hafiz,
mm-hmm.
who held a press conference about 2 or 3 hours before the voting polls actually closed, and that figure was then quoted again by the Election Commission. And really what the minister said, he said, and I quote, although a 72% turnout was expected, okay, mm-hmm. it appears that the participation level will only reach 50%, okay? That was
okay.
what he said. Now, the reporters picked on the 72%, they didn't pick on the 50%, and then 1 hour later, an official of the Iraqi Election Commission held a press conference to which you had all the, you know, the international reporters, embedded reporters in Baghdad were there. And he said, yes, the turnout is very good, blah, blah, blah. And he confirmed the 72. And then he said that he expected the voter turnout to be actually 60%. Okay, so that first it was 72%, then it went down to 60, and then reporters started saying, well, how did you actually arrive at these figures? And he said, well, you know, these estimates came out of the offices. They were based on observations, feelings of the human flow at the polling stations. Now, imagine Iraq, Fallujah, under the rubble. You know, no computers, and you have feelings that the people going through there and so on and so forth. We're talking about a country of 25 million people and, 13 million registered voters. Now, how are you going to tally all those, that voter participation, and then get it back to a central location in Baghdad 2 hours before the polling stations closed and then say that the turnout was as high as 60%.
Okay? Well, it's impossible.
It's impossible even in America with with all the technology. But here you're holding an election in a war theater, essentially. That's what people don't want to discuss. Is that the country is under occupation. The occupying forces have killed, according to a very authoritative source, which is the Lancet Journal of the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health.
Right.
They've killed 100,000 civilians, and now they're organizing free and democratic elections in a country which is virtually devastated. And they expect us to believe and to accept this as a transition to democracy.
Well, the next point that you had highlighted in your article was about a boycott that was generated. And it talks about the boycott not limited to the Sunni triangle. Can you elaborate on some of the boycotts that were active during that election process?
Yeah, well, the thing is that in fact, the Sunnis, which represent something like 20% of the population, has said we're not participating in this election. And all the press reports are saying, well, you know, that Iraq is sort of cut into different religions, okay?
We've got a break coming up, Michelle. Right after this break, I believe. Do we have a break? I just heard music. Well, we don't have a break, but
we don't have a break.
Well, I heard music.
Essentially, what the news is trying to tell us. Is that Iraq is not really a country with, it's made up of Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds and Christians and so on, and that this is a mosaic, and that none of these people actually talk to one another, and in fact the boycott was not only by the Sunnis but an important segment of the Shiite population as well, and then you had. Of course, what's his name, Mullah Sistani, who's the main Shiite leader. He supports the election, but you have other Shiite leaders who don't. And the resistance movement to U.S. To the U.S. occupation is essentially, it brings together everybody. I think everybody is against the U.S. occupation.
Well, that's a point I wanted to bring up. That was a future question I had to ask you. It's pretty clear, if you speak to anybody who's knowledgeable about this subject, that they are non-secular in their agreement that they want the Americans out. And that's clearly the opposite message that they're giving on American television. I mean, they're specifically saying that there is no cohesion between any of the disparate groups, and as a result, they actually talk about the fact that there might be civil war and all this other stuff, when the fact is there is quite a concerted effort against the Americans by all the groups, non-secularly. And can you tell us what you found out about that?
Well, I would say that's certainly true for the Sunnites and the Shiites. The situation in Kurdistan is a bit more complex because there's a separatist movement. You know, they want to separate,
right.
You know, like Texas in way back.
Yeah.
interestingly enough, and the media never mentioned this, that in Kurdistan, people on their ballot could vote against Iraq. They could vote in favor of a separate Kurdish state, and they would put an X next to a Kurd. If they were against being with Iraq, they would put their X next to a Kurdish flag, and if they were in favor of Iraq, they'd put it next to the Iraqi flag. And that was, of course, had nothing to do with the so-called constitutional process. It had to do with a referendum on whether Kurdistan would actually be part of Iraq.
Well,
and
are any figures coming out about the response about this particular element of the election, or?
Well, you see, I mean, since it has been very, it hasn't been covered, all I can say, I saw a couple of press reports. One was actually in the Boston Globe on the 31st of January.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, I quote, many northern polling stations also held an unofficial referendum on independence, asking voters in favor to check a box next to a Kurdish flag and those against to check an Iraqi flag, unquote. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and then you had a couple of other sources which indicated that this was taking place. And I mean, if that is on the ballot, it's of course an issue, because it really means that electoral process is predicated on the fracturing of Iraq as a country. Okay.
Well, whether we're
in favor of that or not, but it's something we should know about.
Well, you know, you have to understand too, and I mean, I'm going to bring my listeners up to speed if they don't know this, that Iraq was an invention of the British some 100 years ago, and that in fact, in advance of this country that they invented, the borders they invented, Iraq was a tribal nation where the borders were not defined as a country of Iraq. And so, you know, over the life of this country called Iraq, many of these people have held on to the idea of re-separating themselves into their old structure. We're going to take a break, and we've got great questions ahead for my guest, Michelle Shostadovsky. Please hang on, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back. A great conversation with Michelle Shostadovsky. My name is Daryl Smith. You're listening to The French Connection, and we've been talking with Michelle about the elections in Iraq. And I actually want to shift gears after this break. We've got about a 10-minute break, a 10-minute period here, Michelle. I wanted to talk to you about the convenient insertion of Mr. Zarqawi right around this election cycle and what effect that might have played, what kind of role that might have played in this past election. I mean, they seem to insert him when they feel he's needed for manipulation of some kind. What do you know about that?
Well, you know, I've written a very extensive review of Zarqawi, which was published a few months ago, and it looks like this guy is all over the place.
Yeah,
he's in Madrid for the 3/11 bombing. He's in the United States. He's in Colin Powell's speech, and the question you really ask yourself in reviewing all this is, to what extent is this individual actually real?
Well, have you looked out your window? Do you see him running by your house right about now?
Well, the thing is that I think, first of all, we have to understand that in a country under occupation, under military occupation, there is a resistance movement.
Yeah.
There's not Zarqawi, one guy, and incidentally, CNN describes him as a lone wolf, okay? Now, it simply doesn't make sense that this lone wolf would be fighting, multi-billion-dollar military operation in Iraq with intelligence and so on, and then they say we don't know where he is and we can't catch him. Okay?
Haven't they said he was dead a time or two?
Yeah, they said he was dead, but then they said they describe him as an Osama associate. Then they say they don't know. They only have a picture of him. They don't know much about his family history, and so on. And you go through a little bit of this material, you realize that he crops up right at very specific moments. The first time that he really emerges is in Colin Powell's speech to the United Nations Security Council on the 5th of February 2003, a month before before the war. Okay,
yeah.
And that's where Colin Powell says, he was, as we know, he was, his speech was heavily criticized by people like Hans Blick at the time, by the UN inspectors and so
right.
on. And he says, I want to bring to your attention the sinister nexus between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. And this guy, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, an associate and collaborator of Osama bin Laden and his Al-Qaeda lieutenants. And then he says, he talks about this chemical weapons plant in northern Iraq, okay, which is being used to sponsor chemical and biological attacks. And this was really the basis of the weapons of mass destruction pretext, which was ultimately used to invade Iraq.
And on top of that, they used this man also as the link to the Afghani insurgency and the Al Qaeda connection, didn't they?
Well, absolutely. Now, first he was in Afghanistan, and then he was in Iraq, and then he was. He was up in northern Iraq, actually in Kurdistan, with where he was producing ricin, this chemical which is used in biological attacks. And then when U.S. special forces went in, they said, that was the basis of Colin Powell's statement. When they went in, they said we didn't find anything. They just found, I'm quoting here from a report in London's Observer. He said, there's no sign of chemical weapons anywhere, only the smell of paraffin and vegetable butter used for cooking in the kitchen. I discovered some chopped up tomatoes, but not much else. The cook had left his Kalashnikov propped neatly against the wall. Okay. Now, that yep. is, of course, a journalist's account. But again, when U.S. Special Forces with their embedded journalists entered this camp in northern Iraq, and that was at the height, of course, that was during the campaign in March of 2003,
mm-hmm.
What they found, essentially, they said they didn't find anything. And so what you have is the creation of some kind of a legend. They say this guy Zarqawi is doing this and that. He's in charge of this, that. He's in charge of radioactive dirty bombs. And each time there's something happening, Zarqawi emerges and
he's the go-to guy. He's the guy that they use.
He's the bogeyman. He's the image of the guy, the bad guy, okay?
Well,
and it's a way of really skirting the fact that there are people fighting against U.S. occupation.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation immediately after the break. And Michelle, thanks for that information. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll be right back with you. Great to be with you on this Monday. My name is Daryl Smith. I am the witness, and you can contact me at iamthewitness@hotmail.com with any of your questions or suggestions for my show. We've been talking with Michelle Shaw Sadowski today about the election fraud that took place in Iraq. And Michelle, I wanted to bring up a point that you brought up. You didn't call it this in your statement about Zarqawi, but you alluded to this fact. And they use a Hegelian dialectic to create a bad guy, create a situation, ferment the injury to whatever, and then they use that same event and create their own solutions to the problem. And it seems like Zarqawi comes available to them whenever they need to promote a bad guy that needs to be destroyed. And so they're using this guy in the press as a way of promoting whatever. I mean, he's used in different roles. I see his change, like this last time for the election, they used him in a video, and it was pointed out to me by a future guest of ours, Felicity Arbuthnot, that this man has a wooden leg, according to witnesses, and the person standing in those videos doesn't seem to have a wooden leg.
Yeah, well, this is precisely it. There are lots of occurrences where this guy appears and at appropriate moments. I remember the Madrid March train bombing. Now all of a sudden, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is there in Spain. A few days earlier, he's in Iraq, I think first of all we have to understand that the propaganda ploy, the disinformation ploy, is really to give a face to the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And it is also to deny the fact that there's more than one individual fighting against the U.S. occupation. You know, it's not just Musab al-Zarqawi. It's hundreds of and maybe thousands of people who are involved. Now, in contrast to that, there was a resistance movement in Fallujah, which went on for months and months and months. And then they said, oh, it's Zarqawi who's there, who's fighting against. And, of course, this doctrine is then used to mobilize U.S. troops.
Exactly.
I mean, that's what they're told. There's a bad guy in there. Go and get him. Okay?
Yeah.
But in the meantime, 100,000 people are killed. And so we have this. It's almost unreal. Now, I'm not suggesting. I mean, maybe this guy exists. Okay, whether
yeah.
he exists or not, I don't think is the issue. The issue is really understanding that U.S. occupation forces are not fighting so-called terrorists. I'm not saying that they aren't terrorist acts. They may be, but essentially you're in a war theater, so you're fighting an enemy, And the U.S. public and public in general around the world is led to believe that these are a bunch of hooded people who are confronting the most powerful nation on earth and its occupation army of 100,000 men and women, and that somehow Zarqawi is the bad guy, and once we catch him, we resolve all the problems. We can have elections, democracy, and so on.
Well, you know, you brought out something quite interesting about these elections, and I'd like to maybe shift the gears just a tad because we're running kind of quickly through this hour. We've got almost 2 years now in this theater. 2 years coming up in March, you know, so we're about 3 weeks to a month away from 2 years. And where do you see this? I mean, personally, after this election, this sham. And we've already touched on the point that there is cohesion against the Americans there. What do you see coming up for this place, Michel, in your estimation?
Well, you know, quite some time ago, there was analysis of what the U.S. Agenda would be for Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And the appointment of John Negroponte as ambassador, of course, is crucial in that regard, because John Negroponte has a track record. He was ambassador to Honduras in the early 1980s, and he was responsible for overseeing the death squadrons in the war in Nicaragua, in the civil war in Nicaragua. And that's been well documented. Different organizations, the U.S. Congress, are cognizant of this. And so you send somebody like Negroponte to Baghdad, who has a track record of political assassinations, death squadrons, and so on. And what you get, that's precisely what you get. I think it's worth mentioning that targeted political assassinations have been acknowledged as something which the U.S. administration will be involved because it's precisely because they're fighting the bad guys. Okay.
Now, why couldn't we get Mr. Wolf from our Homeland Security over there?
Yeah.
Just, I mean, he seems like a perfect fit for the job. I you know, it seems to me, okay, that since these guys are cohesing together, I mean, if you bridge the gap between the Shia and Sunni, and they've kind of put their differences behind them, and even many forces coming out of Kurdistan that have not been have been maybe working as a secular type of movement, it seems like this problem America's facing now either is going to remain consistent or get worse. Now, is that how you're seeing this happening right
now?
Well,
you know, I mean, it the thing is that the U.S. occupation is applying divide and rule strategies within Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
They're pushing one group against the other. People who may be united in their common resolve against the foreign occupier are now being divided. They're building links. You know, they're promoting Kurdish separatism on the one hand, sectarianism and fundamentalism essentially is part of the game, because Iraq was broadly a secular Muslim society. If you recall, that's what happened in Yugoslavia. The Croats,
yeah.
the Serbs, the
mm-hmm.
Croats,
mm-hmm.
the Bosnians. I mean, they were all the same people. They had slightly different religions. They spoke the same language, and essentially, what happened was the fracturing of Yugoslavia into a number of smaller U.S. or EU protectorates, and one group pushed against the other. The whole country impoverished beyond belief, I mean, through macroeconomic reforms and the situation is still ongoing. And then you set up in Kosovo the largest one of the largest U.S. military bases, Bonsteel, which was built by Dick Cheney's company,
yeah.
Brown and Roots, his subsidiary of his company, Halliburton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the other question I do have, though, I mean, we talked about this privately. When do you think they're going to reinsert Shalabi? I mean, because we all know that Shalabi was not on the outs with these people. They just kind of used him as a they wanted him to be saleable to the Iraqi public. So what they did, seems to me, is they made him a bad guy and threw him out into the public, saying, okay, we're mad at him. He's a bad guy. And, of course, they're hoping that the Iraqi people will embrace him as being against the Americans, which we know is a bunch of malarkey. Do you see him being reinserted into this equation?
Well, you know, I see several possible scenarios. One scenario is the scenario of civil war. Okay,
yeah.
which is something which U.S. foreign policy has always favored, and push one group against the other and create conditions for fracturing and maybe even simply Iraq disappears as a country. So that is certainly a scenario, and I think it's contemplated by U.S. foreign policy makers. The second is to install a U.S. protectorate with some kind of bogus democracy, and then you need to have your puppets. Ahmed Shalabi was the guy they brought in.
Mm-hmm.
it's just incredible, because he left. He left Iraq when he was age 13, and he's a U.S. citizen. His family lives in the U.S. He has a U.S. passport. And then 40 years later, no, more than 40 years later, he goes back to Iraq.
As the savior.
As the savior, yeah. And he's escorted in by U.S. troops. And then everybody, of course, in Iraq, everybody sees this guy is really a stooge of the CIA. And of course, they turn against him.
Hasn't he been reinvented? Hasn't he been reinvented in
some
way?
Well, that's it. I mean, what happened is that then they had, then the United States accused him of betraying American intelligence secrets to Iran. Okay,
right.
They don't arrest them; they simply accuse him of collaborating with Iran, and he is in a sense they signify that they don't trust him anymore, but they don't do anything against him. Okay, he just sits there.
Right.
I should mention that Chalabi happens to be buddy-buddy with Paul Wolfowitz because they went to school together at the University of Chicago. You know,
just by accident, right?
Just by accident. Yeah, just by accident. Chalabi is, and Chalabi is also involved in the rebuilding of Iraq. He has a nephew who's called Salem Chalabi, who runs a law firm, which is bringing in foreign companies into Iraq. So they're all making money out of this. And but you're right. I mean, the only way you're going to have a credible U.S. puppet installed is if the U.S. says we hate this guy. Okay.
Exactly.
And he's working against us. And so I think I think people have to understand that the current regime there of what's his name, Alawi,
yeah,
is a disposable regime.
Isn't the first regime after this always the one that they get rid of?
Of course.
And the puppet ends up in a year later or so.
Well, that's a possibility. These are disposable puppets right now. They're there just for transition, and then after that they're going to become so unpopular, and they're criminals. I mean, we know they're criminals. Okay. I mean, we know that Alawi is a criminal. He goes and shoots people blank, and he's also complicit in the tortures and massacres of his own people. So he's
somebody
criminal.
You really love as a neighbor over at your house, right?
Yeah, and so I mean, the Iraqis know that, and they want to now, and that's why they from some of the reports we got in is that the people who voted were led to believe that if they participated in the election, the U.S. troops would go out. And
okay.
And immediately after the election, they said, oh, no, the U.S. troops have to stay to ensure a democratic transition. See?
Well, Sistani now is got a lead. I'm assuming Sistani has a lead. One of the things that surprised me some months ago was that Sistani was not totally fighting against the Americans or even speaking out against them. And as I understand from some of my other conversations with people in the know, Sistani is probably one of the most powerful Shia mullahs, period, regardless of what country, I mean, including the mullahs in Iran. So what is this guy's position toward the Americans at the moment?
Well, I think that the question we have to ask ourselves is, how does a more sort of radical fundamentalist Islam favor a theocratic type of state, favor U.S. interests against the more, the more, I don't know what term to use, but let's say you take Muqtada al-Assad. I mean, this guy.
Right.
I mean, he's anti-American. He's anti-occupation. I'm not saying I shouldn't use the term anti-American. Anti-occupation. Okay.
I haven't heard much from Muqtada in months.
That's correct. But I mean, his it's maybe because the media's not talking about it. His organization did not actually say we boycott the election, but they said they're not supporting it.
Okay.
And so that does still represent an important segment of the the Shias of the Shiite community, but the thing is that Ayatollah Sistani represents the sort of conservative Shiite, and I think he really does sort of favor a theocracy, I mean, that's, and that in a sense is what, that's the model in the Middle East.
Hey. Couldn't he call? I mean, couldn't one word from him, one shout out to his supporters in the country, and the Iranians as well, get the Americans kicked out of there? I mean, he's got maybe 10 or 15 million followers in Iraq alone, and probably as many in Iran. Couldn't he, with one word, have the Americans sent packing?
Well, but for the moment, he hasn't done that. He's supported the elections, and the U.S. officials have said, have praised him for his so-called moderate views, and he doesn't make political statements, and so he is really a good guy from our point of
Well, the media is portraying him as a go-along guy. I mean,
yeah.
He's not looking like a guy, but it seems like a word from him would really tip the apple cart over here. I'm wondering what his loyalties are. That's the thing that comes to
mind. Well, maybe his loyalties are complicit in the sense that he's turning a blind eye to the fact that his country is occupied, and that is that's really the issue. He didn't like Saddam Hussein. He doesn't like secular Iraq.
Well, we got one more break, and we got a closing part of the show, and we're going to pick this up right after this message. Please listen to our sponsors. We're back, ladies and gentlemen, and it's great to have you online here today, Michelle. I wanted to speak to my listeners for a second here and promote your site again. It's www.globalresearch.ca, and I'm going to tell everyone, in my estimation, it's probably the most informative website on current issues and world events that I think the web offers. In fact, it's probably the best in the world. You know, the Patriot community in America is probably the best informed community there is. And the RBN listeners we've got the best information coming from all different sources. And I want everyone to know that I'm going to try to bring the truth to you so that when you watch this malarkey that they try to throw at you on mainstream media, you can just look at it and go, my goodness, the lies coming out of these people. The last thing I wanted to, you know, give you a chance to speak about, Michelle, you know, we do have Felicity Arbuthnot coming on Wednesday regarding this subject and some others. Are there any things you'd like to see her develop in this debate that we've had here for an hour? Michelle?
Hello?
Yes, Michelle.
Yeah. Felicity is an absolutely first-class writer and journalist. She was a longtime friend of lifelong friend of Margaret Hassan, who was as you recall, was executed, and she knows the background of that. She knows Iraq very, very well. She's a war correspondent. So I'm very happy that, and she contributes to our website off and on.
Yeah.
I think the important thing for us in the United States and Canada is really to uncover the lies behind this war agenda, and stress the fact that the war is a violation of international law. It was waged on a false pretext, weapons of mass destruction. We know that pretext was fabricated because the administration has actually acknowledged that it was fabricated because they didn't find any weapons of mass destruction. And they're contradicting their own statements by saying that it doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. So there you are. You mobilized 150,000 troops, who are also the victims of that war. American servicemen and women are the victims of that war.
Yeah.
They're fighting for a cause which is which derogates the most fundamental principles of international law, and that war is a criminal war. And therefore, and I wrote an article on that, I said, abandon the battlefield. That is what we have to... That's not an individual decision. That's a collective decision. And I say that because Canadian troops are also involved in this war. They're involved in the war in Afghanistan, and that war is also criminal because it was based on the idea that Osama bin Laden was attacking America and that we had to go out and invade a country when there was absolutely there was no evidence that Afghanistan, with a population of more than 20 million people, were actually attacking America.
Well, you know, this is the end of our hour. One of the problems with an hour is it's not enough time, Michelle.
Okay.
You're a wonderful guest, and I count you among my friends, Michelle. Thank you so much
for being on my show today. It's great to talk to people in Texas. I'm a graduate, actually, of the University of North Carolina.
Well, you're actually talking to me in France. You're actually talking to me. Merci, Michel.
Well, thanks very much.
Okay, listen, ladies and gentlemen, aware that Robbie Noel's on and just after my show, and I'd like to thank you all for being my guest today. And have a great evening. Bye-bye now.